boat ashore. They pass joints around, then bags of chips or paper sacks of snickerdoodles from Amy's bakery. Always, someone would strip down and dash for the water, and Kirby was never far behind. You'd think the water would be colder at night, but in fact it felt warmer. It was also scary. She couldn't see the size of the waves coming up, or her own legs, or what lurked beneath. There was a very real fear of sharks, who were rumored to feed at night. But this only heightened Kirby's sense of exhilaration. There was nothing quite like floating on her back, gazing up at the stars and moon. She misses those nights, so much so that she considers asking Tommy to swim. They'd have to go in their underwear, she supposes, or go nude. She dismisses the idea. Instead, they walk. To the right, which is west. Tommy doesn't speak or reach for Kirby's hand, and Kirby figures he's probably sore, but she isn't going to apologize for dancing. This isn't a date, not really. They are only adjuncts to Patty and Luke's growing passion. Kirby thinks briefly about sharing her concerns about Luke with Tommy, but he's Patty's brother, and the last thing he likely wants to discuss is his sister's sex life. Kirby meanders toward the water and gets her feet wet. The water glows where she kicks it up. Look, she says, phosphorescence. Tommy ventures in, and the two of them spend a few minutes splashing, laughing when the water lights up. Then, on the beach, Kirby spies the bone-white shape of a quahog shell. Excellent, she says, picking it up. I've been looking for one of these. Ashtray? Tommy asks. Soap dish, actually, Kirby says. She rinses it at the water's edge. It's perfectly intact, with a swirl of blue and white, like the ocean itself inside the shell. I'm on a tight budget. Tommy laughs at this, and Kirby knows she's forgiven. He takes her hand and pulls her to him, and she knows what's coming. Sure enough, when she lifts her face, he kisses her. His timing isn't bad. It's dark, they're on the beach with their ankles awash in sparkling water. Things couldn't really get any more romantic. It's his execution that's the problem. His mouth is open too wide, his tongue is thick and meaty, and he seems intent on choking Kirby with it. She tolerates a second or two of this, wondering if things will magically improve, ruminating on the mystery of human chemistry. Will Tommy someday meet a woman who thinks his kissing is amazing and who can't get enough of it? Kirby presses her hand to his chest and, to his credit, he stops. We should get back, Kirby says.
I guess you're right, Tommy says miserably.
A few days later, Kirby hears from Rogini. The Aldworths have taken their boat and their bratty kids to Cuttyhunk, she says. They're paying me to stay at their house with their cat. You're kidding, Kirby says. She has had so little contact with Rogini that she knows almost nothing about the family she nannies for. She didn't know they owned a boat, that their kids were bratty, or that they had a cat. All she knew was that they lived in Chilmark. Why don't you come over? Rogini says. We can swim at their private beach and then go to Menemsha for lunch. They left me the keys to their Porsche. Kirby doesn't have to be asked twice. She borrows Patty's bike and rides all the way out to the address Rogini gave her on Tea Lane. It's farther away than she thought, but it's pretty along State Road. She passes rolling farmland and stone walls, ponds and big trees. The landscape is different from Nantucket, where the bush is low and windswept, and most of the trees are scrub pines. Finally, Kirby turns onto Tea Lane and pedals all the way out to the water. At the end of a shell driveway, the house number she's looking for is carved into a stone. A little farther down, the house itself comes into view. It's palatial, three stories, with a turret at one end. Around the side is a swimming pool and tennis court. As Kirby is kickstanding her bike, Rogini appears in the entrance, her arms spread wide. Welcome to my home, she says. Away from home. The house is grand. There's a white piano and leopard skin rugs and what Kirby thinks is an Andy Warhol hanging in the kitchen next to the fridge, in the same place that another family might hang their children's crayon drawings.
The kitchen is modern. All of the appliances are avocado green, a color that pops against the white tile floor and the pink and orange mosaic backsplash. Kirby follows Rajani outside to the deck. The pool is off to the left. Down three steps and over one small dune is the ocean.
Are you kidding me? Kirby says. You work here every day? Why didn't you tell me?
Too busy running after Eric and Randy, she says. The demon twins. Kirby is stunned. She was wowed by Luke Winslow's place on Nashaquitza Pond, and in some ways she prefers it to this. Who needs a grand piano and leopard skin rugs and a Warhol in a summer home? Kirby always felt privileged growing up because of their house on Fair Street, right in town, and the mural in the living room, and their long legacy at the Field and Ore Club. But now that she has seen this house and Luke's house, she understands that Fair Street is nothing special.
Wanna swim? Rajani asks.
Kirby strips down to her bikini and races for the water. At lunchtime, Rajani plucks the car keys out of a ruby-colored glass bowl. I think the Aldworths have key parties, she whispers, and they climb into Mrs. Aldworth's Porsche 911 and zip across Chilmark to Menemsha. Menemsha has been built up in Kirby's mind because she's been told it's a can't-miss destination. But when they arrive, she finds it's a teeny-tiny fishing village, a working fishing village. There's a small harbor crammed with fishing vessels. All of the boats now at midday are unloading their catches. The avalanches of slippery silver fish look like quarters running out of a slot machine. There are enormous wooden traps bursting with lobsters. Kirby blinks behind her cat's eye sunglasses.
Who is going to eat all those lobsters?
We are, Rajani says. Come on. She pulls Kirby into a nondescript building with a sign that says Homeport. Guests at the inn rave about the Homeport, and Kirby loves how understated it is. If people aren't coming for the decor, they must be coming for the food. Rajani marches up to the counter and orders two lobster lunches. Kirby marvels at how confident her friend sounds and how beautiful she looks with her bronzed skin and dark hair and hazel eyes. She's so much more relaxed now that it's summertime, and she's away from the pressure cooker of the college. The lobster lunch turns out to be a pound and a half boiled lobster, an ear of corn, a cup of chowder, a dish of coleslaw, a mini loaf of dense white bread, and lots of butter, both in packets and drawn. Over Kirby's protests, Rajani springs for both of their lunches.
What the Aldworths pay me is obscene, she says.
They sit at the only unoccupied table, and Rajani crushes a claw between the silver arms of the cracker.
So, what's new with you?
Kirby blows across a spoonful of creamy chowder flecked with fresh parsley. What to say? She has already filled Rajani in on her job, the serenity she finds in the wee hours, the kind guests and wonderful Mr. Ames, the pending visits from singers, movie stars, and senators. Should she tell Rajani about Patty and Luke? Should she tell Rajani about Darren? Rajani has known Darren for years, but if Darren told Rajani that he and Kirby met and that they went on a date to the carousel, wouldn't Rajani have said something? The good news is that before Kirby has to decide what to say, their lunch is interrupted. The bad news is that the lunch is interrupted by Darren himself. Kirby blinks. Darren Fraser is standing next to their table, flashing that drop-dead gorgeous smile as if he can't believe his fantastic luck. He's with an older gentleman whose completely bald head gleams like a polished bed knob. His father, the judge.
Fancy seeing you two Oak Bluffs girls all the way out here, Darren says.
Darren!
Rajani jumps up to give him a hug, then turns to his father.
Your Honor!
Rajani.
The judge says. He takes her hand in both of his, then kisses her cheek.
We haven't seen you once all summer. How is this possible?
While Rajani explains her nannying job, Darren turns to Kirby.
I'm glad we bumped into you, he says in a voice meant only for her. I've been meaning to stop by to apologize for Sunday night. Something came up.
something came up. Kirby wants to know what exactly, but she can't very well get into a deep discussion with him right now, and so she shrugs and says, "Don't worry about it." Darren reaches for her hand and gives it a surreptitious squeeze. Kirby feels a thrill zip up her spine. "Meet my dad," Darren says. He clears his throat. "Dad, this is Rajani's friend Kirby Foley." The judge shakes Kirby's hand. "Pleased to meet you, Kirby."
"We go to Simmons together," Rajani says. "And I converted Kirby to the vineyard way of life, even though her family has a home on Nantucket."
The judge's eyebrows lift. "Ah, you're the one who lives on Nantucket. Yes, my wife mentioned you."
Kirby feels her smile drop a fraction of an inch. "The vineyard is a lovely change," she says. "I'm working the front desk at the Shiretown Inn."
"Well, please give Mrs. Benny our best," the judge says. "Darren, should we get this lunch home before it's cold?" He smiles at Rajani. "Enjoy your lunch."
Kirby runs through the entire interaction over and over again as she bikes home from Tea Lane. The judge was perfectly amiable, she thinks, until he figured out who Kirby was. Then he cut things short. Or maybe Kirby is being paranoid. A paper bag holding the remains of her lunch swings from her handlebars. The bad news is that, after Darren and his father left the home port, Kirby was unable to eat a bite of food. The good news is that Rajani was so caught up in describing what happens at the Aldworths' key parties that she didn't even notice. The next morning, when there is only a scant half hour left in Kirby's shift, Mr. Ames comes into the back office holding a red rose surrounded by greens and baby's breath and wrapped in cellophane.
"For me?" Kirby asks.
She knows the flower can't be from Mr. Ames himself. He's married and has never shown anything more than an avuncular interest in Kirby. But she worries it might be from Mr. Rochester in room 3. Mr. Rochester is a rotund, bespectacled, bald man of at least 30 who has been sent by AAA to rate the hotel. Mr. Rochester had leered at Kirby upon his return from what must have been a Chianti and Sambuca-soaked evening at Giordano's and invited Kirby up to his room for a nightcap, which Kirby had naturally refused, even though she realized that it might sabotage their chances for a respectable rating.
"Not Mr. Rochester?" Kirby asks.
"I've been sworn to secrecy," Mr. Ames says.
Kirby puts the rose in a bud vase and sets it on the desk. She supposes the flower could be from Bobby Hogue, who was back at the inn this week. He's such a nice man, though even older than Scotty Turbo, and Kirby wonders whether she could be in a relationship with a man with a missing hand. Yes, she decides. If Darren were missing a hand, she would still like him. When it's time to leave work and head home, Mr. Ames tells Kirby to go on out front. He has to check in with Mrs. Benny for a moment. Kirby thinks this is strange. They don't usually overlap with Mrs. Benny, who arrives at 9, but she steps outside anyway. There, idling at the front curb, is Darren in his red Corvair. When he sees Kirby, he hops out of the car and races around to open the passenger door.
"Ride home," he says.
She can't believe this is happening. Darren is here at the inn at 7 o'clock in the morning to take her home. He's not wearing his white t-shirt and shorts, which means he isn't on his way to work. He came only to see her. And Mr. Ames is in on it. Darren is the one who brought Kirby the rose. Kirby keeps her cool. "I'd love it," she says, as she folds her legs gracefully into the front seat. "Thank you."
I heard it through the grapevine. Kate never would have guessed it, but Bitsy Dunscombe drinks even more than she does. It's a Friday night in July, and they have managed to score a decent table at the Opera House. This alone is reason to celebrate. Bitsy calls their waiter over and orders champagne, the best, a vintage Krug. Bitsy Dunscombe, née Entwistle, of Park Avenue, New York City, and Main Street, Nantucket, was born an aristocrat.
She married Ward Dunscombe, whose family owns platinum mines, and now Bitsy has more money than everyone else on Nantucket combined, or close to it anyway. Kate finds Bitsy's blatant displays of wealth obnoxious, except in situations like this one. As the piano tinkles away and the regulars sitting at table one hoot with laughter, Kate and Bitsy make quick work of the Krug, and Kate eats one of the tiny gougères brought out by their waiter before they order their martinis. Bitsy isn't Kate's first choice of dinner companion on a Friday night, but the two of them do make a tradition of getting together once a summer, and neither David nor Ward is coming to the island this weekend. So when Bitsy called, Kate thought, why not, and accepted the invitation. David called the night before to say he was bogged down in a case and couldn't get away, but Kate knows he's keeping his distance on purpose. He'll show up when she cuts back on her drinking, when she can make it through a short phone conversation without hiccuping or slurring her words, which hasn't happened since she arrived. As for Ward, well, everyone knows that Ward Dunscombe has a mistress on Long Island. Her name is Kimberly Titus, and she's the daughter of Reggie Titus, Flower King. Even Bitsy knows, and she seems to accept it as a matter of course. When Kate informed Bitsy that David wasn't coming this weekend, Bitsy said, "Does David have a Kimberly in Boston?" "No," Kate said. "He has a job." As soon as the words were out of her mouth, she knew Bitsy must find her naive and way too trusting. But Kate had been married to a philanderer once, and she wasn't crazy enough to do it a second time. David is principled. If anything, he's too principled. Kate is the one with the dark secret and questionable morals. One martini, two martinis. Kate orders the escargot to start, and Bitsy the hot appetizer, a crepe of seafood tossed in bechamel, which she barely touches. "Shall we order wine?" Bitsy asks. This seems excessive. Kate is already seeing double, and the garlic from the escargot is repeating on her, so she eats a piece of bread slathered with the sublime French butter. But the question was, of course, rhetorical. Bitsy calls over their waiter and keeps him at the table far longer than is necessary, hanging onto his arm, asking obnoxious questions about Sancerre versus Chablis, when she has already announced that she's ordering Le Boeuf for her main course. When poor Fernando or Arnaldo, Kate can't remember the man's name for love or money, finally escapes, Bitsy looks at Kate across the table and says, "I'm sleeping with him." Kate nearly chokes on her bread.
"With whom?"
"Arturo," Bitsy says. "He comes to the house after service and throws pebbles at my window." Kate brings her menu up to her face to shield the aghast expression she can't wish away. Bitsy Dunscombe is sleeping with an opera house waiter. Kate realizes there's a sexual revolution going on in the rest of the country, but she never thought it would infiltrate the upper echelons of society here on Nantucket. "Don't judge me, Katie Nichols," Bitsy says. Kate dislikes her childhood nickname, although Bitsy is one of the few people who has known Kate long enough to use it. They'd taken sailing lessons together when they were only 11 years old. "I know you've always thought you were better than me with your four perfect children, but I have news for you." So this is Bitsy Dunscombe fueled by one too many, Kate thinks. She gets ugly. Not only her language, but her face as well. Her expression contorts into a hideous mask with narrowed, accusing eyes and twisted lips. If she says anything about Tiger, Kate will slap her or throw a drink in her face. The piano player will stop right in the middle of "Try to Remember," and the revelers at table one will gape first and gossip later, and who could blame them? Kate Levin and Bitsy Dunscombe are two middle-aged matrons, both impeccably bred and raised, who should be able to get through dinner at the opera house without making a scene. No, Kate thinks. She pulls her comportment out as though it were something tucked away in her pocketbook. "I never thought I was better than you, Bitsy. You have beautiful twin girls. You were much smarter than I. You didn't make the mistake of marrying too young." "Don't patronize me," Bitsy whispers fiercely. "I won't have it." At that moment, Arturo arrives with the wine, a Cabernet that will complement both Bitsy's Boeuf and Kate's Canard. As Bitsy goes through the theatrics of tasting the wine, Kate gazes around the room. The opera house is tiny, a jewel box, really, dark and magical, with the iconic velvet-lined phone booth in the corner where Kate once caught Wilder kissing the Broussard Swedish au pair. Wilder had been drunk, too drunk to know what he was doing, so Kate had forgiven him, despite the public humiliation. Kate thinks of poor Blair, probably at that very moment lolling on the couch in front of the television like a walrus on an ice floe, stuffing her face with grilled cheese sandwiches and pudding cups. Kate encouraged Blair to stick it out with Angus, even though Angus is engaging in an affair with the woman named Trixie, who can only be a prostitute, because that was what Kate herself had done. She stuck it out. But why should poor Blair have to suffer as Kate did? For propriety's sake? Propriety means next to nothing these days, as Bitsy Dunscombe is so plainly demonstrating. Why shouldn't Blair be with Angus's brother, Joey, if that's who she really loves? Blair deserves to be adored. All women deserve to be adored. "I'm sorry, Bitsy. Your words came as a shock," Kate says. She lowers her voice. "I assure you, I would never judge." "You should be positively ashamed of your daughter," Bitsy says. She takes a long drink of her wine. It stains her lips purple. Kate wonders if Bitsy has heard about Blair. Her presence on the island can hardly be kept hush-hush. The news must have circulated that Blair and Angus are having marital problems, and perhaps someone got hold of the sordid story about Angus kicking Blair out of the apartment because he caught her with his own brother. But who would have leaked such a story? Exalta? Exalta meets Mrs. Winter for mimosas every morning. She might have said something accidentally, and everyone knows how Mrs. Winter holds a grudge against Blair for dumping her grandson, Larry. Or maybe Bitsy is referring to Kirby? Maybe news of Kirby's arrests made it from Boston to New York? Or maybe Kirby was involved with something even more nefarious? That spring, Kirby came home from college unannounced for 3 days midweek. She had offered no explanation and stayed holed up in her room, refusing all meals. Kate was traumatized by Tiger's recent departure, but even so, she expressed concern and asked Kirby a few probing questions, which were batted back in her face like shuttlecocks. Over the years, Kate had learned that with Kirby, emotions ran hot and hard for a time, much like the outdoor shower at All's Fair, and then returned to normal. Sure enough, when the weekend rolled around, Kirby returned to Simmons, resigned if not cheery. Kate was secretly relieved that Kirby had decided to spend the summer on the vineyard because it gave her one less person to worry about on a daily basis. 4 children had seemed so perfect, so square. But Kate has to admit, much of the time it feels like too many. "To which daughter are you referring?" Kate asks. She tastes the wine. It's exquisite, but that only serves to annoy her, and regards Bitsy with open curiosity. "Jessica," Bitsy hisses. "She stole $5 from Heather's pocketbook while Heather was using the ladies' room at the club. $5 and a lip gloss. Heather didn't want to say anything, but Helen was in the next stall, and she spied on Jessie through the crack in the door. She said that Jessie reached right into Heather's Bermuda bag, took the money and lip gloss, and walked out." Kate rolls her eyes. "Spare me, please. Jessie would never do such a thing. I would bet my life on it." "Helen saw her, Katie," Bitsy says, "and Heather admitted the money was missing. She earned that money by..." "Reading to the blind," Kate interjects. She's sick of hearing what a tireless do-gooder Heather is. She's a Girl Scout. She feeds stray dogs. She takes the elderly for walks in their wheelchairs. Admittedly, Heather is far better than that little minx Helen. Helen has been trouble from day one. Of course she's trying to pin this robbery on Jessie. Helen probably took the money herself. "Helen probably took the money herself," Kate says, "and she's trying to blame Jessie. How have you not considered that?" "Helen said Jessie did it. That's enough proof for me. Helen doesn't lie." Jesse doesn't steal.
Maybe she was doing it to get attention, Bitsy says.
She leans back in her chair and lights a cigarette.
I'm sure that's it, poor girl. One sister is pregnant with twins, one sister is raising hell on Martha's Vineyard, and she has a brother at war. I feel sorry for Jesse, which is what I told my girls. Let her keep the money and the lip gloss if it makes her feel better.
Arturo arrives with their dinners, and Kate stands up. You two enjoy, she says. I'm going home. She tosses her napkin on her chair and weaves her way through the dining room, past the godforsaken phone booth, and out to the patio, where she waves goodbye to Gwen, the owner, who is deep in conversation with the artist Roy Bailey.
It was a wonderful evening, as always, Kate calls out. Thank you.
She rages as she walks back to the house. Bitsy Dunscombe is well, frankly, the right word eludes Kate, but Bitsy certainly knows how to put an end to a lifelong friendship. Kate will never speak to her again. How dare she accuse Jesse of stealing and then insinuate it's because Kate doesn't pay enough attention to her? Kate passes Bosun's locker and considers stopping in for a drink. All the regulars would likely fall off their bar stools or laugh her right out of the place. Wilder used to go to Bosun's, and Kate would either call and ask for him to be sent home or march down and yank him out of there herself. Those nights were preferable to the nights when she stormed into the bar expecting to find him, and he wasn't there. She will not go to Bosun's locker. But maybe the charcoal galley? The 6 escargot and piece of bread didn't do much in the way of filling her up. She could go for a greasy cheeseburger with griddled onions and a side of gravy fries, but she figures she's likely to bump into the same characters from Bosun's at the charcoal galley this time of night, either filling up after a day of drinking or fueling up before a night of drinking. She turns left onto Fair Street. She's loaded for bear, as the saying goes. She has let Bill Crimmins have enough time. She will knock on his door, who cares if he's asleep, and demand answers. Has he heard from his brother-in-law about Tiger's discharge? She knows that he hasn't. If he had, he certainly would have let her know. But Kate will ask anyway. She expects results, and soon. Kate is 2 houses away when she sees a taxi pull up in front of All's Fair. For an instant, her heart soars. It's Tiger, come to surprise her. Or it's Kirby. Yes, Kate does miss her wild second daughter terribly. She would be delighted if it's Kirby. Her night would be salvaged. Or maybe it's David. Kate wishes she hadn't drunk half a bottle of champagne, 2 martinis, and a glass of Cabernet. David has come after all, but he will see that nothing has changed. Kate is a lush. Worse, a drunk. Even in the dark, she distinguishes the figure of a man. So, David. Kate rushes forward, thinking her only hope at this point is to throw herself on his tender mercies. But as she gets closer, she sees the man isn't David. It's Angus, Dr. Angus Whalen, who sees fit to cheat on his wife while she's pregnant with twins. Stop right there, Kate says, and Angus does indeed freeze in his tracks on the sidewalk in front of the house. Angus is smart, but not particularly strong or intimidating. With his glasses and his pointy nose, he resembles nothing so much as an intelligent mouse. Kate feels affronted on her eldest daughter's behalf, plus she's furious with Bitsy. This does not bode well for Angus.
What are you doing here? Kate asks.
I came to see my wife, he says.
His eyes follow the taxi as it drives off down Fair Street.
First of all, she's asleep, Kate says. Second of all, you have some nerve showing up here unannounced after throwing your pregnant wife out.
Kate squints. The street is dark and she's having a hard time seeing Angus clearly. She's happy that the anger in her voice masks her advanced state of drunkenness.
How dare you?
I caught her with my brother, Angus says. Did she tell you that?
She did, in fact, Angus. She said you misconstrued their embrace. She was merely seeking comfort from Joey because she'd discovered your infidelity.
About that,
Angus says. But Kate doesn't want to hear any excuses or explanations from Angus. She was married to a serial philanderer for 10 years. She has heard enough excuses and accepted enough apologies to last the rest of her life. Kate notes how satisfying it is to reject this disgusting behavior instead of accepting it, as Bitsy Dunscombe is doing, and as Kate once did. Blair may end up divorced, but at least she'll retain her pride. "I'm asking you nicely to leave this island and never return," Kate says. "Blair deserves better. Maybe your brother will know how to treat her, and if he doesn't, she will easily find someone else. You and I both know that, Angus. Go now, please."
"I need to talk to her," Angus says. "I need to see her."
He pulls at his hair, like a mental patient, Kate thinks.
"She's carrying my babies."
"You should have considered that before you strayed," Kate says, "and before you asked her to leave. Good night, Angus, and goodbye."
"Kate, please," Angus says.
Kate tries to recall if Angus has ever used her Christian name before. He's 10 years older than Blair, so he might feel like a contemporary of Kate's, though he most certainly isn't one, and they aren't fond enough of each other for him to call her mother. He should be addressing her as Mrs. Levin, but to correct him now would only keep him here longer. "My next step is calling the police," Kate says. Anyone who knows Katie Nichols Foley Levin would realize there's absolutely no chance of her bringing lights and sirens into a family matter. But Angus Whalen doesn't know Kate, and so he backs up to the street, holding his palms up.
"All right, all right, I'm going," Angus says. "Just please tell Blair I came to see her."
Kate nods, a gesture that could mean almost anything. She waits outside until Angus heads down Fair, turns onto Main, and disappears. Summertime Blues, Reprise. Her grandmother's necklace is gone. Every time Jessie says these words in her mind, she feels a wave of nausea. Twice she has actually vomited, though she hasn't eaten much in the days since the necklace went missing. Her mother asks each morning if she's feeling okay. "She looks peaked," Kate says. And then to Blair she says, sotto voce, "It's probably puberty. Before long, Jessie will be a woman." To which Blair responds, "Poor Jessie." Neither of them has any idea about the predicament Jessie is in. The gold knot necklace with the diamond is gone. Jessie lost it. The only person who knows about it is Pick. The instant Jessie made the gut-wrenching discovery, she started to shake and cry, and her hopes for her first romantic interlude changed into something else entirely.
"What's wrong?" Pick asked. "Jessie, what is it?"
She was back to being Jessie, not Jess. She was a child who had been entrusted with something valuable, indeed, something priceless, and she had lost it. She tried to explain to Pick between sobs, but she had to be quiet because the last thing she wanted to do was alert Mr. Crimmins. Mr. Crimmins, most certainly, would go straight to Exalta.
"My grandmother's necklace. I wore it to dinner, and now it's gone," Jessie says.
"Oh, geez," Pick had said,
but it was clear from his tone that he didn't understand the situation. He was a boy. Boys didn't care about jewelry or about sentimentality, even though Jessie went on to explain that her maternal grandfather, Pen Nichols, long dead, had given that necklace to Exalta for their first wedding anniversary in 1919. The necklace was valuable, too, gold with a diamond. This, Pick had an easier time grasping, and so they got down on their hands and knees and searched every inch of the floor of Little Fair. Then they sneaked outside and checked the flagstone walk and the strip of grass between the houses. Pick had pulled a flashlight out of the utility drawer in the kitchen, but the batteries were nearly dead. The light was watery and barely any help at all. They checked the deck, and then, once inside All's Fair, they ran their hands across the linoleum of the kitchen floor. They came away with toast crumbs, dried tomato seeds, and cereal flakes, but no necklace. They moved out into the hallway, and that was when they heard footsteps on the stairs. Pick grabbed Jessie by the hand and pulled her through the half-size door to the buttery, the cramped closet where Kirby had been punished so many years earlier. The buttery was dark and smelled like damp brick and mold, but it was a decent hiding place. No one would think to look for a person in there. They crouched down side by side, by necessity, their bodies pressing together. Pick squeezed Jessie's hand, but she was too nervous to enjoy any thrill. She could tell by the weight and the pace of the footsteps that the person awake was Exalta. A moment later, they heard low voices in the kitchen, one of them a man's, so it must have been Mr. Crimmins. Jessie was trembling. Pick slid an arm around her back and maybe tried to kiss her, but he ended up burying his nose under her jaw. "Turn your face," he said. So it was true. He was trying to kiss her. But at that moment, the footsteps came back their way, and Jessie froze and couldn't help thinking of Anne Frank hiding in the attic of the skinny house in Amsterdam and how frightened she must have been with the constant threat of the Nazis. Exalta went back up the stairs. Pick and Jessie stayed quiet and still for a few minutes after all noises in the house had subsided, and then Jessie pushed the door to the buttery open and stepped out, and Pick followed. Wordlessly, they went back to Little Fair, and when they'd climbed the stairs, Jessie said, "There are leftovers. Help yourself."
"You're going to bed?" Pick asked. "Don't you want to go out on the deck and eat?"
She shook her head. There was a lump in her throat that would make it impossible to swallow. She wanted to curl up in a ball and die quietly of anxiety. It could have been, should have been, the best night of her young life, the night of her first kiss. But it was ruined. She didn't deserve happiness. Even so, she managed a weak smile. "I'll look for the necklace again in the morning. I'll retrace my steps all the way back to the Mad Hatter if I have to."
"Good idea," Pick said, but his mouth was full. He was already into the scampi.
Jessie slept fitfully, waking up for good when the sun rose at 5:30. She had fallen asleep in her dress, which she took off and kicked to the back of her closet. She would never, ever wear it again. She put on shorts and a t-shirt and her Keds and hurried down the stairs and out the door and through the side gate to the alley. Nantucket was pretty at 7:30, when she and Exalta would walk to the club for tennis, but at 5:30 it was even more beautiful. The air was dewy, the light pearlescent. Fair Street was still. Jessie might have been the only person awake. She wished she could enjoy it, but she was too agitated. If she had lost the necklace on the street and someone had found it, then it was gone forever. It could have been picked up by a bird and woven into a nest. It could have been run over by a car, the chain broken, the knot flattened, the diamond dislodged. It could have fallen into a sewer grate and become mired in the muck and gray water that ran beneath the island. Jessie cast her eyes down as she traveled the exact path back to the Mad Hatter that she and Kate had taken home. Glints in the sidewalk turned out to be mica, which felt like a cruel trick. Ditto the tabs from beer and soda cans that littered the brick outside of Bosun's locker. As Jessie crossed Main Street, she looked in the crevices between the cobblestones. Meanwhile, she tried to imagine telling Exalta that she had lost the necklace. Jessie wasn't even supposed to have the necklace. She had, essentially, stolen it from Exalta's bedroom. This made it so much worse. Two things to admit to instead of one. Jessie got all the way across town without encountering another soul, which was fortunate because she had no explanation for what she was doing out and about this early. When she arrived at the Mad Hatter, she climbed the steps and knocked on the glass pane of the door, but no one answered. She could hardly be surprised. It was barely 6 in the morning. As she wondered what time the cleaners came in, wondered if maybe they had found the necklace last night, under her chair, say, she gasped. The necklace wasn't at the Mad Hatter, because Jessie had touched it at her throat on the way home. On Main Street! Jessie hurried back across town to the spot in front of the Pacific National Bank where she remembered fingering the necklace. She started there and searched every square inch of pavement diligently until she was back at All's Fair. It had to be somewhere, she reasoned, but it wasn't. It was gone. Now, a week later, worry about the necklace has grown into a full-blown crisis. Every day when Jessie wakes up, she fills with dread, expecting that this will be the day Exalta realizes the necklace is gone. Thursday evening, when Exalta goes to bridge at the Anglers Club, Jessie sneaks back into her bedroom. The air is chilled. The high single bed is made with crisp white linens, and the burgundy velvet box is on the triangular table. The sight of the velvet box is as gruesome to Jessie as a severed hand. She experiences a glimmer of hope as she pries the box open. For one second, she imagines that she can change the past, that a week ago she did not abscond with the necklace out of anger, but left it right where it was. The box is empty. Jessie's stomach lurches. She thinks about taking the box. Will Nani notice its absence? Will taking the box lessen the chances of Exalta suggesting, on some future special occasion, that Jessie wear the necklace? Maybe Jessie should take all the jewelry from the triangular table. She can leave the boxes open and askew, make it look as if they've been robbed. Yes, Jessie thinks, this would solve everything. And it's not too far-fetched. They leave the doors unlocked night and day. Anyone could just come in and walk off with the jewels. But there is rarely, if ever, a time when the house is completely unoccupied, especially now that Blair is here. And somehow Jessie knows that if she stages a burglary, the person who will be blamed is Pick. Blair, Jessie thinks. She will confide in Blair and ask her advice. Blair seems pretty miserable. She could probably use a distraction. Maybe, just maybe, Blair will give Jessie the money to replace the necklace. She can go down to S.J. Patton on Main Street, describe the necklace, and commission a new one. Jessie leaves the burgundy box where it is and heads down the hall to her room, which is now Blair's room. The door is closed, so Blair is inside and not downstairs in front of the television, thank goodness. It's impossible to tear her away from the flying nun. When Jessie knocks, Blair utters a froggy, "Come in." The air conditioner is humming, and Blair has the drapes closed against the sun, which is still fairly bright even at 7 in the evening. Blair is wearing the yellow dress that is starting to come apart at the seams. When she sees Jessie, she offers a smile and heaves herself up to sitting. Her hair is messy. She wears no makeup, not even lipstick, and her girth is so shocking, she looks as if she's harboring an entire family under her dress. "Hey," Blair says. "Hey," Jessie says. She closes the door and sits on the bed next to Blair. "I have a problem." "Boy troubles?" Blair asks. Jessie shakes her head as she thinks of being crammed into the buttery with Pick and how he basically asked to kiss her and what a missed opportunity that was. Yet this concern is pale and distant compared to the red-hot urgency of the missing necklace. "Is it... did you get your..." "No," Jessie says. She thinks back to her last evening in Brookline, Leslie announcing that she had officially entered puberty, Doris clutching her belly against imaginary cramps, and she marvels that she had ever been so innocent. She takes a deep breath. "Nani gave me a necklace for my birthday. It was a gold knot with a tiny diamond in the center on a gold chain. I guess Gramps gave it to her for their first wedding anniversary." "Wow," Blair says. "And she gave it to you to have? Like, permanently?" Jessie's eyes fill with tears. "She did. It was supposed to be a special occasion necklace." "I should think so," Blair says. "But she was keeping it for me in her room. And last Thursday night when Mom and I went to the Mad Hatter, I put it on. Without asking Nani, I mean. She was at bridge, so I couldn't ask her." "Yeah?" Blair says warily. "And I lost it," Jessie says. "It must have fallen off my neck. I've looked everywhere in this house.
I retraced my steps through town. I checked to make sure it wasn't caught inside my dress. It's gone, Blair.
Blair falls back against her pillows with her fingers laced across her belly.
Jesse, she says.
I know,
Jesse cries.
You don't have to make me feel bad about it because I already feel rotten, and you don't have to tell me I'm irresponsible with nice things because that much is obvious.
Oh, Jesse, Blair says. I'm so sorry.
It's priceless, Jesse says, wiping a hand under her nose. Gramps gave it to her in 1919. It lasted 50 years, and then I had it for one night, and now it's gone.
I take it you haven't told Nonny, Blair says.
I can't tell Nonny, Jesse says. I just can't.
She's going to find out sooner or later, though. You know that, right?
I was hoping you could give me money so I could go to the jeweler and ask them to make another one, Jesse says. It doesn't have to be exact. Nani's eyesight isn't that great. If she doesn't look closely, she won't notice. And I'll pay you back every penny, I swear.
Blair laughs.
Oh, honey.
Jesse assumes that means no. She bows her head. Her only hope now is that Exalta won't notice the necklace is missing for the next 6 weeks, at which point Jesse will go with Pick to Woodstock and never return.
Wait right here, Blair says.
She lumbers across the room to the bookshelves and scans the titles. These books are mostly old. Some belong to their mother growing up. Some belong to Nani. Blair extracts a slim volume and presses it on Jesse.
Read this, she says. Then you'll know what to do.
The book is The Necklace and Other Stories by Guy de Maupassant. Jesse takes the book back to Little Fair and lies across her bed to read it. She is out of options. The first story, The Necklace, is about a woman who wants to impress people at a fancy party and borrows an expensive necklace from an acquaintance, and then loses it. She finds a similar necklace in a jewelry store, and she and her husband sell everything they own and take out multiple loans to buy it. She gives this necklace to the acquaintance without mentioning that it's a replacement, and the couple spends years in poverty, the wife doing scullery work in order to repay the loans. A decade later, she runs into the acquaintance and finds out that the necklace she lost was not valuable at all. The jewels were made of paste. When Jesse finishes the story, she slams the book shut. This doesn't help her because the necklace she lost wasn't a fake. It was real, the real necklace that Nani received from Gramps, right? It had the heft of gold, and the diamond looked genuine. Maybe Blair thinks Nani gave her a decoy to see if she was ready to care for a fine piece of jewelry. That would be such a relief, but Jesse doubts it's true. She understands why Blair suggested the book. There's only one correct course of action. Tell Nani the truth. When is the right time? On their way to tennis lessons? On their way home from tennis lessons? In the evening, after Nani has had a couple of gin and tonics? Jesse starts scrutinizing her grandmother's moods. Every time she imagines telling Exalta the truth, she feels sick. She can't do it. Then, after the 4th of July, Exalta spends a long stretch of time in the den watching Wimbledon on TV. Her favorite player, Rod Laver, wins his quarterfinal match, then his semifinal match. And then he wins the final match against John Newcomb. He is the Wimbledon champion once again, and Exalta claps her hands with glee. When Jesse sits down next to her on the sofa, Exalta turns to her and says, "Isn't that marvelous?" Jesse wants to blurt out the words, "Nani, I lost the necklace." But she can't bring herself to ruin Exalta's good mood. That evening after dinner, Jesse returns to Little Fair to find an envelope on the kitchen table. She creeps toward it, as though it's a dove that might fly away. What are the chances that someone found the necklace and left it in this envelope for Jesse? She squeezes her eyes closed, then bravely opens them, thinking that whatever the envelope is, it will be fine. It's a letter, addressed to her here at All's Fair. The return address is Private Richard Foley, U.S. Army. It's from Tiger. J. Jessie falls into a seat at the table and fingers the envelope. She wants to rip it open. She holds the letter in both hands and considers doing that, but somehow she knows she has to wait. Wait until after she has told Nani the truth. The next morning, Jessie wakes up to pouring rain. She puts on her whites and pulls her hair into a ponytail, though clearly there'll be no tennis today. Just a run through the backyard to All's Fair leaves her drenched. Nani is sitting in the kitchen in the green kimono with the embroidered hibiscus that she got in Japan before World War II. She's drinking a cup of coffee and reading the newspaper, which is unusual. But then Jessie sees she's reading the sports page. There's a large picture of Rod Laver. "Tennis lessons canceled," Exalta says. She gives Jessie a kind smile. "You can go on back to bed." If Jessie was looking for a sign, she has found it. Going back to Little Fair and burrowing under the covers as she listens to the patter of rain against the roof is a tempting choice, but it's also a cowardly one. Jessie takes a seat across from Exalta. "Nani, there's something I have to tell you." Her grandmother gazes at her with interest. Exalta isn't wearing any makeup, so her wrinkles are revealed, and there are pouches under her blue eyes. Her lips are the same color as her skin. Her hair, which looks silvery blonde when combed, now looks gray, the color of steel. Jessie tries to imagine her grandmother as a 13-year-old. Of course, that would have been in 1907, before most people had automobiles or flew on airplanes, before Russia was an enemy.
"I lost your necklace," Jessie says. "The one Gramps gave you for your anniversary."
Exalta blinks, and this split second while Exalta is processing what Jessie just said is the worst moment of Jessie's life. The silence that follows is equally awful. Jessie sees no choice but to fill it.
"I took the necklace from your room. I wore it to dinner with Mom last Thursday."
Exalta executes a nod so slight, Jessie wonders if she has imagined it. But it's followed by a change in Exalta's expression. The corners of her mouth fall a fraction of an inch. She isn't frantic at the news or appalled. She is simply disappointed. Jessie has revealed herself to be as untrustworthy as Exalta feared. Not worthy of the necklace. Not worthy of the family.
"You took it without asking," Exalta says. "Do you know what that's called, Jessica?"
"Stealing," Jessie says. A bolder, braver version of herself, Jessica Levin at 18, or even 16, might have pointed out that since Nani had given her the necklace, it was hers, and by definition, she couldn't steal something that already belonged to her. Nani might then have pointed out that she had decreed that the necklace was for special occasions only, but dinner at the Mad Hatter qualified, right? Nani hadn't meant that Jessie had to wait for her high school graduation or her wedding, had she?
"Stealing," Exalta repeated.
She made the word sound vile. Only criminals stole, Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger.
"And this isn't the first time you've stolen something, is it, Jessica?"
"I..."
Jessie falters. What does Nani know? Jessie inhales and prepares to... what, lie? Cowards lie. She sits quietly for a second and regroups. Telling the truth when you've done something wrong is the most terrifying thing in the world. Never mind that Jessie was angry. Her tennis instructor touched her inappropriately. Her grandmother refused to let her use her own last name. Her brother had been called up by Selective Service. Her actions weren't justified.
"No," she says. "It wasn't the first time.
Mrs. Winter told me that Bitsy Dunscombe told her that you took $5 and a lipstick out of Heather Dunscombe's bag. And I told her that I would bet all of my worldly belongings that this was not the case. Do you know why I said that, Jessica?"
Tears rise at the vision of her grandmother defending her against Mrs. Winter and Bitsy Dunscombe.
"Why?" Jessie says.
"Because I thought you were different from the other three children," Exalta says. "I thought you were sensitive and thoughtful, trustworthy."
At this, tears fall.
"Now I see I was mistaken."
Jessie cries. She sobs. It's too awful. Not that Exalta is disappointed. This she could have predicted. What's awful is that Exalta had believed in Jessie, that she attributed wonderful qualities like sensitivity and thoughtfulness to her, and Jessie hadn't realized it. She knew she was different from the other three children, yes, but she had always felt lesser somehow. Small, dark, strange.
I'm going to sit here while you retrieve the $5 and the lipstick, Exalta says. I will return them.
Exalta will return them? Isn't the correct punishment to make Jessie give the money and the lip gloss back to Heather, along with a full, mortifying confession and apology? But then Jessie understands that Exalta needs to save face. Jessie runs through the rain back to her bedroom at Little Fair. She opens her top drawer and pulls out the $5 bill and the Bonnie Bell lip gloss, and the wristbands and the Twizzlers. When she gets back to the kitchen and drops the items on the table, Exalta looks unsurprised.
Is that everything?
Except the necklace, Jessie says. The matter of the precious heirloom, lost forever, seems to have been forgotten.
Mr. Crimmins found the necklace caught between the floorboards in the hall, Exalta says. Lucky for you. And I have tucked it away for safekeeping.
Jessie's relief can't be described. She feels so light she could float. Mr. Crimmins found the necklace. She is happy, not because she's been let off the hook, but because she genuinely cares about the necklace.
Don't worry, I'm not taking it away from you, Exalta says. But I will retain custody of it until you're older. 16, perhaps.
I don't deserve it ever, Jessie says. This is how she feels. The necklace would be safer with Blair or Kirby or even, eventually, one of Blair's children.
Don't be ridiculous, Exalta says. You're perfectly worthy of the necklace, Jessica. You simply need to grow up a bit.
The corners of Exalta's mouth turn up ever so slightly.
I wouldn't choose to be 13 again for all the tea in China.
Jessie can see why. So far, 13 is turning out to be a terrible age.
You'll be punished for the stealing, Exalta says. Grounded for a week. Extra chores. You'll keep on with your tennis lessons, but you won't be allowed to eat at the snack bar afterward. You can come home and eat. It's against my nature to keep a child inside on a summer day, but you leave me no choice. You'll stay home in the afternoons and, of course, the evenings. Do you understand me?
Yes, Jessie says. She swallows. Does my mother know?
Your mother doesn't need anything else to worry about, Exalta says. Now go. Get out of my sight.
Back into the rain, back up the stairs of Little Fair, back to her room, where she closes and locks the door, sheds her damp tennis clothes, and puts her pajamas on again. She is disgraced for certain, but certainly she feels better, not worse. She feels clean. She feels cured. She picks up her copy of Anne Frank and takes out Tiger's letter. Her hands are steady.
June 20th, 1969. Dear Jessie, I need you to promise you won't show anyone else this letter. Our company was ambushed last week near the village of Docklock. We lost over half our men. Jessie, both Puppy and Frog were killed. Frog was hit by sniper fire. One clean shot to the head. Puppy ran out to grab Frog's body and he stepped on a grenade. His right leg was blasted off. So I went to grab Frog and I brought him back to where Puppy was. I ripped Frog's shirt off and used it as a tourniquet on Puppy's leg. And I thought maybe I'd save him. He was still talking, first praying to the good Lord Jesus Christ, then calling to his mama. And I was praying too, saying, God, please don't take both my brothers in the same day. But if you must, take me too. Puppy died in my arms while we were waiting for the chopper. So many men were lost that they've reassigned those of us who survived to other companies. I'm heading out on a top-secret mission, so I'll be out of touch for a while. I'll write as soon as I can. I miss home, Messy. I'm not sure you even know the real reason I call you that. Probably you thought all these years that I was teasing you, the way a big brother is supposed to.
But really, I call you that because when you were a baby, Mom used to let me feed you your baby food. I would hold the spoon with your squash or pureed plums, and half the time you would open your pie hole like a baby bird and take what was on the spoon. The other half, you would reach a little hand out, grab the food from the spoon, and smear it all over your face. Then you would laugh so hard that I would laugh too. That's why I nicknamed you Messy. Since Frog and Puppy died, I've been wondering what the point to all this is. Not just the war, but life in general. I've had some real dark thoughts. I try to picture your baby face covered with plums, and I hear that laugh like heaven's bells, and that keeps me tethered. My kid sister. Who knew? Please don't tell Mom or Nani or anyone else about this letter, or about me going on a secret mission. I already wrote to McGee to tell her. Since I'm sharing secrets in this letter, I might as well tell you that I've asked McGee to marry me. I sent her Gramps' Harvard class ring to stand in for a diamond. We will have a big wedding, if I make it out of here alive. I hope I do, Messy. I hope I do. Love, your brother, Tiger.
19th Nervous Breakdown. No one has said so out loud, but on July 7th, when Blair is less than 4 weeks from her due date, it becomes clear that she won't be returning to Boston for the delivery. She will give birth to the twins here on Nantucket. Buried deep beneath the many layers of emotion that Blair feels on any given day is a fluttery pride and even joy about this. Her children will be native Nantucketers. They will have the same claim to the island as the Coffins and the Starbucks and, this is what really thrills Blair, an even greater connection to it than the summer residents who have been coming to the island for decades, people like Exalta. Blair announces over breakfast toast with her mother, for when Kate is around, Blair is offered only dry toast in an attempt to keep her from gaining any more weight, that they should probably go see Dr. Vandenberg, who delivers all of the island's babies. I suppose you're right, Kate says with a heavy sigh. I'll set something up for today. The appointment is scheduled for 12:30, and despite the heat, Blair is grateful to get out of the house. She has watched day after glorious day slide by while she lies about in bed or watches soap operas in the den. Could we possibly go to lunch after? Blair asks. Kate shocks Blair by saying, Where should we go? The galley, Blair says. She wants a lobster roll with French fries and a tall glass of iced tea with lots of lemon and sugar. Even a few days ago, lunch at the galley would have been too upsetting to contemplate, because that was the spot Blair favored for lunch the summer before, back when she was married but not pregnant, back when she was thin, back when she was herself. But with her due date in sight, she realizes that pregnancy isn't a life sentence. It will end. She will give birth to the babies, and her present misery will become a distant memory. Kate nods in approval. Wonderful, she says. They make the best gimlets. The Nantucket Cottage Hospital is country medicine, but what it lacks in big city sophistication, it makes up for in personal attention. Dr. Vandenberg is a wonderful, welcome change from the smug condescension of Dr. Sayre at the Boston Hospital for Women. Dr. Vandenberg is a short man who has the countenance of a cheerful elf. He's tanned and healthy. He looks as if delivering babies is something he does between sailing and regattas and playing rounds of golf. He's wearing a white lab coat over a baby blue polo and a pair of snappy Madras pants. Blair loves everything about Dr. Vandenberg. He is the apotheosis of a summer doctor. She doesn't even mind when he asks her to lie back on the metal table so he can check her. Being checked, in this instance, means Dr. Vandenberg reaching up inside of Blair, which makes Blair think of Julia Child's instructions about removing the gizzards from a raw chicken. That leads her to remember her 3 failed attempts to make poulet au porto the previous autumn. She wonders if Trixie is an accomplished French cook whose pan sauces never break. Blair is so consumed with envy over Trixie's imagined skills in the kitchen that she isn't listening when Dr. Vandenberg says something from his post between her legs.
I'm sorry, what?
You're 100% effaced and 2 centimeters dilated. The babies should be here in a week, maybe two, maybe sooner.
Blair sits up on her elbows.
What?
When Blair returns to the waiting room and Kate asks how everything went, Blair says,
Just fine. Let's go to lunch. I'm starving.
As they drive to the galley, Blair practices her breathing. She needs to calm down. On the one hand, the news is exhilarating. A week, maybe two, maybe sooner. On the other hand, Blair is forced to consider her circumstances. If she gives birth tomorrow or next week or in 2 weeks, she will be doing it alone. There has been no word from Angus and no word from Joey. The situation is enough to send Blair back to the solace of her bed, but she doesn't want to miss what might be her last chance to get out of the house. The galley offers simple lunch fare, and it's right on Cliffside Beach, a mere 40 yards from the lapping waves of Nantucket Sound. Kate and Blair are seated at a coveted two-top on the outer edge of the restaurant, along the rope railing. Blair positions her arm so it's resting in the sun. The maitre d' is the same man as the year before, though he doesn't recognize Blair. When he saw her approaching, he cleared the way for her as though she were a Mack truck about to barrel through the restaurant. Blair is so happy to be here that she doesn't even feel self-conscious about her yellow dress. The galley isn't a formal place. Nearly all the diners are in bathing suits and cover-ups. If Blair's motivation for being here is to get out of the house and dig into a lobster roll and French fries, Kate's is to start drinking.
I'd like a gimlet, Kate tells the waitress,
a girl of about 17 who has her hair in pigtails,
and another one in 10 minutes.
Behind her sunglasses, Blair raises her eyebrows but doesn't comment. She orders an iced tea and studies her mother. Catherine Nichols Foley Levin, the summertime version. Kate seems to have aged 10 years since Tiger was deployed. Kate's skin is lightly tanned and her hair is loose, held off her face by a grosgrain headband, but there are tense lines around her mouth and etched into her forehead, and Blair knows that if Kate removes her sunglasses, her eyes will be bleary. She wears her pearls with a crisp white short-sleeved blouse, so she's still recognizable as herself, but she drains the first gimlet in under a minute. 3 long sips. Blair counts as she drinks her iced tea.
Mother, Blair says.
Kate gazes at the sea,